Hi, Newstalk's Ciara Kelly here. There is something about summer that makes you want to refresh your home. And for many of us, that starts with the kitchen. It's where the morning coffee happens, where family life gathers, where friends always seem to end up. And after years of wear and tear, it might be time to give it the attention it deserves. So if you're thinking about a new kitchen, Tile Style is well worth a visit, because Tile Style doesn't just do tiles, they also design and supply beautiful kitchens, including the luxurious Porcelainosa kitchen collection. Think high quality, contemporary design, stunning finishes, clever storage, and a look that can completely transform your space. Their expert team can help you plan it all properly with advice and optional virtual design, so you can see how your new kitchen will come together before making any big decisions. And with Tile Style Summer Sale now on, offering exceptional value across the store, it's a brilliant time to start planning with tiles and finishes to perfectly complement your new kitchen. So if your summer plans include creating a kitchen that feels genuine special, start with Tile Style. Visit the Tile Style showroom in Ballymount to see full kitchen displays and finishes up close, or explore more at tilestyle.ie.
The Pat Kenny Show on News Talk.
Good to be with you.
Richard, can you tell us where you see the lie of the land now? Are we in a stalemate?
Well, we're in something of a stalemate, but it's precarious in several senses of the word. One is there's always the possibility that either by intention or by accident, one of the three parties could escalate, resume all sorts of military operations, and then it's just uncertain where things are going. You've got the dynamics on the Strait of Hormuz, where you have, if you will, twin blockades. And you have the possibility, obviously, of a diplomatic process. Iran has opened up that possibility. The United States has thus far rejected a straight-only process. But at some point, depending upon the economic effects of a closed strait, I could see one or both parties suddenly discovering some interest in a resolution of that issue.
Now, if you have a straight-only policy, in other words, somehow get the strait open and maybe have transit fees shared among maybe a group of nations, who knows, but what would be set aside if you had a straight-only agreement?
You would then have, first and foremost, the nuclear issue, the question of what activities would Iran be permitted, what sort of ceiling might be negotiated, what is to be the fate of the enriched uranium that Iran already possesses, and so forth. Then there's a number of other questions. You've got issues, for example, about Iran's support for proxy groups like Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis. You've got questions of Iran's conventional military capabilities, its ballistic missiles, its drones, its navy, its air force. You have the status of economic sanctions and frozen assets and so forth. So the question is, as is always the case, what is the breadth of any sort of agreement or formal negotiations, and what happens to those issues that are not included in the formal negotiations? How are those dealt with?
Now, do you believe that a straight-only deal is fairly quickly doable, or is that still perhaps a number of months away?
Well, there's two issues there. One is whether both sides are open to it. Right now, Iran seems open to it. The United States is not. I've argued the United States should be. That we should essentially be prepared to trade our blockade for theirs. If there were an agreement in principle, if the Trump administration decides that the economic pain we're feeling from a prolonged closure is too great, yeah, I could see a fairly quick agreement, though there is that sticking point, and you alluded to it, Pat, which is how is the management of the strait to be organized? It can't be only under Iran. The other countries bordering on the strait have to have a role. What, if any, fees or tolls could be collected? What would be the level, and so forth? But all that said, if there's strong economic incentive on both sides to open the strait, then I don't see anything that's insurmountable.
Mm. Now, at the moment, we're told that the strait is policed by both the IRGC and by the standard Iranian army, and maybe people don't see the distinction very clearly. How ready would they be to give up those trump cards, if you like?
Well, it's a good question. And one of the ironic effects of the American and Israeli targeting of Iranian leadership is we have a much more cloudy view of the leadership now. And you've got the two groups you mentioned, the regular army and the IRGC. You've also got political figures and you've got clerical figures. It seems to me, though, the upper hand is the Revolutionary Guard Corps, those leaders. And I think it'll ultimately be up to them. That if they're prepared to make a deal, then I think Iran is prepared to make a deal.
Talk to me about the pressures on both sides. I mean, in the United States, the domestic pressure, the most sensitive thing, I suppose, is the price of gas at the pump. And everyone feels it every day. And on the Iranian side is an economy in freefall.
That's pretty close to it. In the U.S., yeah, gasoline has gone from under $3 a gallon to now something like $4.30. It's going up every day. I don't think it's impossible. You know, we could see $5 or $6 average gasoline in a matter of weeks. And summer's the big driving season in the United States. We're only 2 months away from that. But it's not just gasoline. It's also all the things that are made from oil and gas, and you'll see it in fertilizer, the impact on agriculture. You'll see it on plastics, on virtually every supply chain imaginable. We had a meeting of the Federal Reserve Board, the American Central Bank, earlier this week, and one of the arguments for holding off any further reduction in interest rates in this country is simply rising inflationary pressures, and this war and the closure of the strait is obviously contributing to that. Iran went into the war with an economy that was shambles. The war's made it worse. And now the American blockade put into place in response to the Iranian blockade has compounded it. So I think Iran is feeling real economic pressure as well.
And yet we hear about ships getting through to deliver oil from Iran to China, to India, and that the United States is allowing this to happen. And you're kind of extrapolating, thinking, well, is that because we don't really want to impact too much those economies because of putting them into the arms of others who might help them, like Russia?
I'm not sure I see it quite that way. I don't know how many of those ships are still getting through. And my view is we shouldn't let any of them through. And what we want is China and India and others to be pressuring Iran to open up the strait. So I don't believe there should be any exceptions, and we shouldn't allow Iran to export any oil and receive any revenue for it. We want to increase the pressure on Iran, not alleviate it.
Now, the other political pressure in the United States is the questions that are being raised all the time, in spite of many distractions, including what happened to Donald Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner and the fallout from all of that. The concern is, this is a war of choice. Was America wise to get into it at all?
Well, since you're speaking to the guy who came up with the phrase war of choice, I tend to have strong views on the subject. But no, I don't think this was a wise or warranted war. There was nothing that Iran was either doing or was about to do that constituted an immediate unacceptable threat to the United States or Israel for that matter. So I think this was ill-advised. And I think the war was conducted in ways or based upon assumptions that one after another have proven wrong about Iran's ability, its resilience, about how it might respond and so forth. So this has proven to be an extraordinarily costly war in terms of the direct military costs, but obviously also the indirect economic costs. So my sense is that historians, when the time comes, will be extraordinarily critical of the decision to go to war here.
Now, you've written in your blog, Home and Away, about that meeting in the Situation Room in February when Prime Minister Netanyahu was actually present. And, you know, it seems unprecedented that a foreign leader should be welcomed into the Situation Room. Has it ever happened before?
It's a good question. Whether there's foreign leaders who have been allowed into the Situation Room, I'm trying to remember from my time at the White House. I don't think it matters that much in the sense that I've been involved in the White House in any number of, shall we say, intimate discussions with foreign leaders, whether it was the Oval Office, the Cabinet Room. Again, I just can't remember whether they're in the Situation Room at Camp David. There were conversations. I think, again, what was exceptional about this is the Israelis advanced the case and how little expertise there was on the American side. and how quickly the American side, essentially led by the president, said, okay, we agree. And there was virtually no debate. And to me, it really revealed the price we pay for having hollowed out expertise in our government and for the lack of a rigorous process associated with policymaking.
For people who didn't hear about that meeting in the Situation Room and very good reporting from the New York Times on this, Netanyahu was present in person, and then on screens you had Mossad throwing in their tuppence worth in terms of advancing the case for war. And the president very quickly opted for the Israeli argument, which kind of stilled the rest of the voices in the room. When the boss says something, there's a kind of a let's go along with the boss attitude.
100%. And you know, I've written about and talked about the contrast after the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait in 1990, when President George Bush, the senior, had very strong views. But he was urged by his senior lieutenants, Jim Baker, Brent Scowcroft, and others, to hold back. That if he were to speak, it would you would never get the honest take from the supporting cast. So the president held back, and people said what they had to say. So I thought this was again the wrong way to conduct a meeting. And again, the lack of experience and expertise in the room was to me really quite stark.
And do you believe that the Israelis played on that lack of expertise, or were they traveling more in hope than in expectation when they went to Washington?
It's interesting. My hunch is they may have. I think it's important to take a step back and remember that this came, you know, shortly after the American intervention, the limited intervention in Venezuela. So you had not just the Israelis promising great things, talking about regime change and the like in Iran, and playing to the president's ego that he could accomplish what no American president since Jimmy Carter was able to accomplish, which was bringing about the demise of the revolutionary regime in Iran. But the president was predisposed to believing it. Venezuela, from his point of view, was a success that came at minimal cost. So for him, this was another Venezuela. It was another chance to do something quick and easy and quote-unquote successful. I don't think he ever imagined that 2 months later he would be where he finds himself.
When you say the lack of
give me a mountain with lots to do. Give me the sunshine, give me a dew. Give me something simple and true. All I need is sunshine and a cool, refreshing mountain dew. So give me my good hands, give me a dew.
Grab some friends and an ice cold Mountain Dew today.
Mountain Dew.
I mean, there were some voices raised skeptically, the head of the CIA, and even Marco Rubio is credited with some skepticism. J.D. Vance, it is believed, leaked the content of that meeting because he was the one who was so absolutely against the possibility of the war. That question of the competence of the cabinet even, going forward. It is not a war, according to Donald Trump, although he has said that a couple of times in the last few days, that when the war is over, and then when the military operation is over, he corrects himself, that there's no real expertise around him to caution him.
No, exactly. And again, it's not just the cabinet. You would never, in a normal administration, just depend on the most senior figures. They're not expected, quite honestly, to be area experts or country experts or historians. That's why you have staff. That's why you have regional experts on the National Security Council staff, or experts at the State Department, or experts at the CIA. And those seem to be missing from the conversation. The idea that the president would walk into this meeting with his Israeli counterpart, not having been exposed to all sorts of expertise and historical lessons and so forth, and analysis of Iran, that just never would have happened in my day.
Now, the logic for going to war, it changed all the time. We saw Marco Rubio saying the Israelis were going to go, so we decided we go first, that kind of thing. Whether that stands up to any kind of scrutiny, I don't know. But dangling regime change, and then the focus more nowadays on the nuclear enriched material, which is buried well below ground, that seems to be the focus. So what's to be done with that stuff? I mean, it may well be buried beyond retrieval, and yet they're talking, Hexet is talking about mounting an operation. You know, if they don't give it to us, we'll go get it.
I would call that just this side of preposterous. I can't imagine a more difficult and dangerous military operation. I just don't believe it's even seriously feasible. No, I think there's two choices with it. I don't think there's a military answer to it, by the way. It's got to be resolved through negotiation. When it comes to the existing enriched material, we're talking about 400 plus kilograms of 60% enriched uranium, which is pretty close to what you'd need to make nuclear weapons. There, I think you've either got to dilute it, and there's technical ways of doing that, or you'd have to ship it out of the country to a country that has the capacity to handle such material safely and responsibly. Those are your only two options.
Yeah, and this material, I mean, one would hope that it survived in containment vessels. But with those bunker busters, they may not have, and it may be dispersed into the rock below.
It's possible. I haven't heard or read anything about radiation escaping and people coming down with radiation sickness and all that. But I think what you're saying also reinforces the argument that a military operation would be extraordinarily difficult and dangerous because you might be exposing your troops to that sort of situation.
Now, the question of where that material might go, I know there was an early offer from Pakistan to take it and take care of it. Russia would also be a possible destination. There's something kind of uncomfortable about the idea of sending 60% enriched uranium, which is not far off what is required for the making of more bombs for the Russian arsenal, for example. I mean, who would be monitoring the Russians in that situation?
It actually doesn't bother me that much, at the risk of surprising you, simply because Russia has already such a vast arsenal, and this amount is not going to move the needle. So quite honestly, that doesn't particularly worry me. That's the least of my concerns. And if we could get it out of Iran and it ended up in Russia, I'd be comfortable with that.
We'd love to move forward to the end point, but we might have to go back to 2015 and the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is known in shorthand as the Obama deal. I mean, is it likely that Trump could do any better than the Obama deal if it comes to negotiation about this material?
Possibly. I thought one of the principal weaknesses of the quote-unquote Obama deal, the JCPOA, were what's often called the sunset provisions, the expiration or duration provisions in the accord. So I can imagine certain limits either being open-ended or far longer. I think that's a possibility. And you could also imagine some type of a temporary moratorium on any and all enrichment activity rather than simply putting a fairly low ceiling on what would be allowed. So I can imagine what you might call a JCPOA plus emerging from a negotiation. I think that's in the realm of possibility.
It took 2 years for that deal, though, so it's not going to happen anytime soon. The whole idea of that, as you mention, the possibility of a nuclear weapon, the objective of that deal was to increase what they call the breakout time. In other words, the time when you have this enriched stuff, maybe not enriched enough, but you can enrich it fairly fast from 60% to 90%. So you want to increase the breakout time. In other words, the time from deciding we want a weapon, we'll take the stuff, we'll enrich it further. Bingo, we have a weapon. And then you have to have a missile that can deliver it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the breakout time is probably years anyway.
Well, not from 60%. That's actually, you could do that in a matter of weeks. That's one of the reasons you want to dilute it way down to below 4% or get it out of the country, because that would dramatically increase the breakout time. And then second of all, you've got to have inspectors. You've got to make it extraordinarily difficult, ideally impossible, for there to be an undisclosed nuclear weapons building program, because the last thing in the world you want to wake up one day and be surprised by an Iranian announcement that they have multiple nuclear devices.
Finally, we should hark back to, and I remember it well, when Colin Powell was doing his exposition to the United Nations to justify the Gulf War II under President Bush, the younger. And I found it when I was watching it, it wasn't credible to me that this was all they had. And I think you've been writing about the fact that it wasn't that Saddam was hiding nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction. He was hiding the fact that he hadn't got them.
Exactly right. And, you know, And I was wrong. You know, I was one of those who thought he was hiding weapons of mass destruction. Only afterwards did I learn that I was wrong. And it was a costly but important lesson of the significance but also danger of assumptions. If you go into a situation thinking with a certain mindset, in this case, that he must be hiding weapons of mass destruction, you tend to look at every piece of evidence, every behavior through that lens, through that prism, and it distorts the way you see things. And it was, for me, a costly lesson, but an important lesson in how to undertake analysis. Mm.
The final question really is about what all of this is costing. Now, the estimate, I think, from Pete Hegseth, already $25 billion, but to the world economy, you can probably multiply that several times over. And I'm wondering, where will the impetus to end all of this come from?
Yeah, my sense is the $25 billion number is low. You're right. Whatever it is, the multiples in terms of the impact on the American and global economy will be far, far higher. I think the impetus is likely to come from both sides, from Iran and from the United States, for the reasons we discussed. Iran is feeling great economic hardship, and at some point, certain people there are going to say, hey, this is threatening the longevity, the future of our revolution. And in the United States and the West, not just the fuel prices, but the across-the-board economic impact, which is going to start showing up in equity markets. We haven't really seen it yet. Stock markets have been relatively stable. My hunch is that doesn't last for long.
When I was preparing for our conversation, Richard, I was thinking back to Northern Ireland and all of that, and you were a special envoy to Northern Ireland. I'm wondering, did you ever come across Albert Reynolds, our late and former Taoiseach, during your travels to Northern Ireland?
I did not work with him. When I first took over, it was Bertie Ahern, and I worked with several other Taoiseachs since.
The reason I ask is that Albert Reynolds famously proclaimed himself to be a one-page man. In other words, all briefing had to fit on a page.
That shows particular wisdom.
So I was wondering, is that what Donald Trump is, a one-page man?
I think he might be a one-video man.
Okay. On that note, Richard Haass, former Special Envoy to Northern Ireland and Foreign Relations Advisor to both Bush presidents. Richard, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Pat Kenny Show, Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. on News Talk. Conversation that counts.